Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. I am at beautiful Cafe Greg, the Greg Cafe, at the Bamilla Mall, and it is a beautiful, overcast, gray, dreary day here in Jerusalem, and we love it because it signals that the blessed rain is still coming down upon our land. And not only that, this rain, as I'm looking at drip, drip on Jerusalem, could very well be the last rains of the winter season. And so we've enjoyed this winter very much, but spring is coming, and that's signaled, of course, by the holiday of Pesach, Passover, which is coming, and you can feel it in the air here. And the feeling is not exactly a good feeling. The feeling before Passover is always one of mad, crazed, scared, nervous, lots to do, and most of my friends, and even just the atmosphere in Jerusalem, is a bit frayed, a bit nerved, a bit edged, and that's because the holiday of Passover, classically, is the holiday of liberation, but before liberation, you have to ascend into slavery, of cleaning, of preparing for Passover, and it is the holiday of preparation, if there was one. If Sukkot is a holiday of joy, and you build your huts, that's great. Here, it's like, you best not have one piece of chametz. Sukkot, worst comes to your worst, you can use your friend's hut, sukkah, booth. And Pesach, if you got one piece of chametz, you're in deep trouble. And so that's the atmosphere here. At the same time, we are drinking lattes here at Cafe Greg. By the way, I do want to remind you folks that you are listening to the Land of Israel Network. And also, I am the international spokesman of the Jewish community of Hebron, where the fathers and mothers are interred. And where our father Abraham, who is really the first person to keep the Passover, and Passover was a monumentous day in his life, is waiting for you to visit him over the Pesach holiday, in which there's going to be tens of thousands of people who are going to be coming to Hebron. But I'm not here alone here at Cafe Greg. I'm with our beloved co-host for our spiritual cafe, Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the show.
We finally got some quality coffee.
We got some quality coffee instead of the coffee at Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com, our beloved yeshiva over there at Cafe Greg. It's just a tad better, maybe. But as you can even hear from my voice, I'm a little bit frayed. My mind is a little bit everywhere, and that's because we're getting ready for Pesach. It's an intense holiday coming up.
As you said, the process of liberation is always preceded by an extremely tense time of, slavery, avoda, service, making lists of lists.
Servitude?
The difference really lies in one's consciousness. It's very easy to slide into servitude. And the question of what one is serving in that moment is important. Are you serving your own ego? Are you serving your fear? Are you serving other people's expectations? But when I go piece by piece and basically touch everything I own, which is what really happens through the cleaning process and Pesach. You basically put your hand everywhere it can reach inside your possessions. And I try to keep in mind that what I'm doing is in service of and not in servitude to.
That's interesting. You get to touch all your stuff. I didn't think of it that way.
Yeah, that's really the primary.
It reminds me of Laban, who touches all of Jacob's possessions.
Well, he rifles through, right? But the difference is that the primary expression of freedom that comes with Pesach, as we find it in the matzah itself, is a return to simplicity. It's a return to sort of an equilibrium where everything is on that starting plane. In the same way that matzah, of course, has no leaven, so it doesn't rise. It's flat. It's plain. It's simple. There's water and wheat, and that is it. Right? In the same way, going through and cleaning out, I rolled back my refrigerator today. And found stuff behind there that no one needs to know.
But many rabbits that live behind the fridge.
Yeah, but what the amazing thing is that it represents that commitment to putting out the hand as far as it can reach. Mm-hmm. And to unearthing those things which are really keeping us in slavery. And if you can keep that in mind while you're doing the physical act of cleaning, it can really be quite liberating.
Rabbi Mike, we have a lot of parts of our life, if it's our personalities, that have parts that we haven't touched or we haven't kind of got into. Our bodies oftentimes succumb to lethargy. And, when you stretch, a lot of times you're touching those parts that have not been touched. There are parts of our potential that oftentimes are not actually reached, where our hand doesn't get out there. A part of our dreams that we don't dare look at because our dreams are sometimes bigger than what we think we can do. and we don't actually follow them or go there. So there's a lot of things in this world where we're like, I'm afraid to touch that thing. Are you saying that Pesach in some way is like a liberation from those limitations, those fears, those go to those places that you're afraid to touch?
Absolutely. And I think the source of the courage that underlies that aspect of Pesach is the fact that in many ways it represents a completely new creation. Right? Our sages teach us that there's an argument whether the world was created in Tishrei in the fall months or in Pesach in the spring. And there's no reason to get into the depth of their argument, but the answer, of course, as is always true, is it's an argument, right? And therefore there's a side of truth to both. And the great event of God reaching his hand into history and taking us as a people out of the deepest, lowest place, not based on our merits, not based on our behaviors, but based on a promise that he had made and an expectation that he had for the world, right? And literally taking us one people out of another in a way which had never been seen and never will again shows that the past does not define the future.
The past does not define the future, and yet there are people who would like to get rid of the past so that they can define the future differently than the way it was kind of envisaged in the past.
Well, those are the people who truly are afraid.
Let me just clarify what I'm talking about. I'll give one example. A kind of very famous person in today's modern Israeli political scene is Shimon Peres, who I have heard on many occasions has said that we are too trapped by history, that we need to kind of not worry so much about history, and therefore define our future differently than the past. But what he means is, don't worry about places like Judea and Samaria. Don't give me this talk about ancestral homeland. Don't tell me too much about Judaism and Jewish state. We don't have to be defined by the... And he even has this little meme that he has. He says, we used to be called the people of the book. Now we're the people of the Facebook. Much better. Okay, so there's some people who would like to kind of get rid of history. How do you balance that issue of being a historical people defined very much by our history and by the promises of history for our destiny, as opposed to also what you're talking about, which is a certain liberation out of an internal narrative that very much can limit you, a contract that you've made with yourself, oftentimes a bad contract that you've made with yourself or with the people around you or with your kind of personal life destiny that you need to break out of this Passover?
Well, Peres, in that respect, is the embodiment of the classical Zionist vision. Right? The Zionists were the ones who, in order to free up their energy and build a better future, which, as we sit here in Cafe Greg, it's worth noting that, 100 years ago, that this was a rocky hillside.
let me just correct you a little bit. I recall being a rocky hillside.
It was 15, 20 years ago.
This place.
This specific is,
remember this place being almost a no-go zone.
Yes.
You didn't want to go here to where the Mamilla Mall was. It was dilapidated. There were some broken buildings. And today it is one of the most thriving thoroughfares in Jerusalem.
So the energy that it took to make that happen was a liberated energy. Liberated in that Western cultural sense. I'm liberated from the past. I can do what I want. Don't tell me what to do. I mean, Zionists, in many ways, the Zionist movement was a movement of children that rebelled against their parents. And in that sense, they had to kill their past. However, I think that many of the problems we face as people, problems that you and I have spoken about so much, and problems of vision, what does it mean to true leadership, and what stepping into the greatness of our dreams, as you said, as opposed to being afraid to reaching as far as they go, is because we shrank ourselves in doing that. The past offers a sense of context and scope and momentum and greatness, which, when it doesn't define the future, but rather lends it its vision and energy, can free it beyond all bounds. I mean, this, by the way, to me, is what it means when we say that every person is obligated in every generation to see themselves as if they themselves are going out of Egypt. Right? And there's an argument in how it's said, to see yourself or to show yourself as having gone out, le'ot or le'harot, which is why some of our brothers, Temani brothers and others, have this a tradition of actually dressing up and packing up their bags and walking around the Seder table, because it's not meant to be some symbolic reenactment. It's meant to be a turning, looking deep at the past, and a turning on the hinge of the present toward the future. Now, this is the great wisdom. You ever read any Toynbee?
Sure.
Right? The great British historian at the end of the 19th century?
Right? Arnold Toynbee.
Arnold Toynbee. So his whole perspective on history is based on the study of the civilization. And his question was, when do civilizations die? Right? And his answer ought to give us pause. Because he says, you know, oftentimes a civilization, because of the wealth and energy and momentum, will keep growing even after he claims it's dead. Because you know when a civilization dies? When it ceases to worship its future and begins to worship its past. Right? That when they're no longer forward-looking and simply nostalgic. That's not to mean that one who worships the future, meaning who is forward-looking, doesn't learn from their past, doesn't have a deep relationship with it, but their primary vision is ahead. And that's what happened to us in exile.
Interestingly enough, Toynbee was not a big fan of Israel. He would call us as a people a petrified people.
Yeah, fossilized.
Fossilized
people. I don't know that that really makes him not such a fan. We don't fit his model.
Right.
And nobody likes that. But what's amazing is that we, in many ways, prove his model to be true. Because what did the Zionists do that allowed us to unpetrify, defossilize, or whatever? It's exactly what they did. They cut off the past and began to worship their pioneers. Now, we, in the next generation of Zionists, have to figure out how we tell the story of our past in a way that which engages its power and energy and vision and yet moves it toward the future.
So we talk a lot on the show, in our Spiritual Cafe corner of the Yishai Fleischer Show. We talk a lot with you about narrative of the past, vision for the future. And Passover is really, I would call it a super narrative tool. And I live working in Hebron. I'm oftentimes, you know, looking at the building of the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. And I tell people, this is a narrative driver. This thing is a narrative driver. This thing is so big and so strong and so historical. It tells my story. It doesn't talk, but it lets me talk and tell that story. And maybe one of the most powerful, we have many powerful narrative tools in Judaism, circumcision is a powerful narrative tool. Certainly the Sabbath, which is a priori called a witnessing, it is a narrative tool. But maybe the most physical, concrete narrative tool that there are so many stories of self-sacrifice about, which there's something about the following thing that I'm about to say. It's simplicity and it's power and it's crossing of all generations. Is kind of one of the most symbolic, central narrative drivers of the Jewish people, and that is the plain bread of matzah. Just matzah. Matzah. Flour and water in this process, less than 18 minutes, so it doesn't get... The matzah itself takes about a minute to actually bake, and it's a, you know, it's this flat bread. It's really kind of stale and boring and crackery, and yet it's... When you eat it and eat it properly, there is something that I can only describe as some kind of transfer of data, of historic data. It's a genetic informational disk that is passed down through generations. It reminds me of the old floppy disks.
Except it's not particularly floppy.
It's not so floppy, especially the Ashkenazi version. Maybe the Sephardi version is a little, the Yemenite version is a little floppier. But there's something about this thing and the baking of it. Let me give you just one example. My mom's grandmother under the Soviet Union would bake matzah. And my mom remembers that as being this strange thing that used to happen. There's something visual about it. And, you know, you can make a simple joke saying Jews, you know, love food. And that's true. And really most people love food. But there's something different about matzah. First thing, it's not something you can love that much. I like matzah, happen to be, but you know, it's not some great gourmet moment.
Well, it's not meant to be,
right?
I mean, matzah is called lechem oni, right? With which can be translated as one of two ways: the bread of poverty, which, as you're saying, it's not meant to be enjoyed. We don't even add salt to it when we bake it, right? It's meant to represent the simplicity and the stripped down nature of another aspect of freedom, is that, you know, like a famous woman once said, that freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose.
Right.
Right? And that sense of absolute simplicity and poverty.
Right.
Kemach, flour and water, and that's it. And
right.
Heat. Right? That's one. But the other meaning of it is lechem she'onim alav harbe, that it's a bread that we answer upon, that we speak on, and that's exactly what you said.
Mons
itself becomes a platform, a narrative driver. I very much like that term because the experience around it and the experience of eating it. You know, one of my favorite moments of the entire year is that, you know, there's a specific moment in which we fulfill the commandment, the mitzvah, to eat matzah, right? It's part of the Seder. It's right at the beginning of the meal, right? And there's a lot of intentionality that goes into it, especially like myself. I make the matzah that we use on that night, so it begins the process already tomorrow. And it's the only sanctified eating that is left to us from the Torah's perspective now that the temple no longer stands. You know that?
I never thought of it that
All
way.
Other sanctified eating was the sacrifices. This is it. This is all that's left. So in that moment, one of my favorite moments of the whole year is everything goes silent. You say the blessing over the bread and the blessing over the mitzvah. And then what?
Crunch, crunch, crunch.
Crunch, crunch, crunch on the table. And there's something so funny and so bizarre and so free and so intense about the fact that what we're doing is we're sitting here eating. That's what we're doing. And that is going to carry everything that came before it, everything comes after it. I have memories, like you said, from my family, from my grandparents. You start going back to the generations. My father remembers his grandfather. His mother remembers her grandmother. It's on and on and on and on.
And that's what it's supposed to be, right? That's the matzah thing. Matzah, that's what I'm trying to say. There's something about matzah which carries memory. It's very hard to describe it, but I really do feel that when you eat the matzah, you are somehow imbibing memories. You somehow get, I don't know, you plug into history. You become part of history. And there's something about this thing. It's, you know, and there's a mysticism involved, certainly.
You plug into the future as well, because the mitzvah is to tell your children.
Right.
Right.
Which is another way of saying passing on memory.
Absolutely. It's meaning I hold my own experience in that moment. I think of it in my own life, in my memories, and in telling the story of the past. And then I'm focused, as the head of my own Seder, I'm focused on my children in order that they're at some moment in the Seder. What's the goal? What do I want more than anything else? That one of my children, or all of them preferably, should pop up at some point and say, wait a minute, why did you do that? That's the goal. That moment of wonder.
Well, the technique of the Seder is that the child should be engaged in the exodus of Egypt through basically asking a question, and that's what you're referring to, which is the way that they're going to be involved is they're going to say themselves, wait, there's something off tonight, there's something different tonight, and I want to know about it, and I'm personally interested in it, and I'm also allowed to be intellectually curious in Judaism, and the parents are kind of teaching. I think the Seder night is not just about the transfer of the story of the exile, exodus from Egypt, but also what's it like to be a Jew? And the way it's like to be a Jew is you ask questions. You get to be curious. It's not about the mystery. It's about your dad trying or your mom trying to answer a question, and you're allowed to be a curious child.
The curiosity is something we're trying to fill our children with, but there's something that underlies it, which is actually what I meant when I said, hey, why did you do that? Because you know what lies underneath curiosity? Wonder. If someone is trapped in a world in which they actually believe they understand and they more or less know what's coming next,
right,
and be it in a scientific worldview, in a narrative worldview, in their own educational process, then they may be able to generate a little bit of curiosity and may learn new things. But this is teaching us something fundamental, not only about what it is to learn, but what it is to be a Jew, which is that you have to engage the world with that openness to the fact that you don't know what will be. Because, of course, who was born in Nisan? Where do we get, I mean, you mentioned that great day for Abraham. And why is Abraham so connected to Nisan? His son Isaac. And Isaac's birth represents the fact that, what does it mean that a 99-year-old man and a 90-year-old woman who had been barren her whole life now have a baby boy? It means that the world is not at all what I thought it was.
Right. So Passover is coming, and with it, the preparation for Pesach, there's a general nervousness in the air, and it's very real. I have had the blessing of working in organizations that are manned and womaned by Orthodox Jews, And therefore, basically, the last week before Pesach, it's really a no work week. You really can't work normally. And oftentimes, you know, I might not even have a show next week because we have so much to prepare for Pesach. We have so much to do, and I personally become under the auspices of my wife. I'm under her command, as we say in Israel, taf pei, tachat pikud. I fall under her, like I become her employee, her.
Servant.
Right, I become like her worker, and I basically clean, and she checks it, and it's a very funny relationship. And also, Jewish men, if you're married like I am to a Hungarian woman, you basically have to excuse your wife from too much nicitude in the next week. There's something that happens. Also, a genetic memory kicks in. There's a tension involved in getting rid of something. There's a expiation, a what's the English word, kirtsuf, so really like scrub it. There's like a scrubbing that happens. And in fact, our great teacher, the Ari HaKadosh, the Arizal, said that sweating in the preparation of the matzah, it cleans you out like a burning fire, like a river of fire. It burns you out, especially from lasciviousness and those kind of sins.
Anything which heats the body.
That's right. It's a great expiation. And I'm very personally also excited about, also, you yourself are in the throes of preparation for matzah baking. I, too, am going to be baking matzah next week. For me, there's another personal thing, which is my great-grandparents in Poland were bread and matzah bakers.
Mm.
That was their profession. So when I show up at that fire, it's like again, a collective memory comes in, and it's like, and also, I this is something that I must tell every Jew who's listening, and also every non-Jew, find a Bible, a Jewish profession, a biblical profession. Learn to do something in Judaism and not just be a bystander. Learn to read the Torah, learn to stand up in front of a quorum and pray, or learn to tie your tzitzit. Learn to do something physical in Judaism. You know, learn to build a mikvah. What else? Give me another example.
You can learn to write the letters of the tefillin in the mezuzah.
Something,
you can,
right?
Yeah, there's the many crafts in Torah, and I think you're absolutely right, because there's a power of action which transcends all the intellectual constructs and all the philosophy and even the emotional elements. There's something extremely visceral about action.
So, speaking of action, this week's Torah portion is Metzora, which is, again, what we talked about last week, the spiritual boo-boos, the blemishes that come from improper speech, and this week's Torah portion is going to focus in on that. And one of the most amazing parts of this Torah portion is that there is a disease, a spiritual blemish that's going to fall. Sure, you expect it on your body. That could happen. We're familiar with that. But it could also happen to your clothes. And even more weirdly, it could happen to your house. As you come into the land of Israel, if you don't behave nice, your house could get sick. And if your house gets sick, you've got to take it apart brick by brick, take out those bricks, and it's got to be kind of quarantined and studied by the priest, the Kohen. And it's kind of shameful because everybody sees you kind of being exiled from your own house.
All your stuff's out on the sidewalk.
Right, you're a bum. you're messed up. But we also learn an amazing thing. And the great commentator Rashi tells us, and the Talmud tells us, that there's sometimes a good reason for this expiation, this kind of embarrassment. And that is that the Canaanites, before they left the land of Israel, when they heard that the Jewish people were coming, they hid some of their treasures in the walls. So your wall may get sick, and you have to take apart the bricks of the house, and then, lo and behold, there is treasure behind the bricks. And I think the deep meaning here is that sometimes bad things happen to us, but really it's actually hiding a treasure behind it. And we have when we deal with the boo-boo that happened to us, if we got delayed, we got stuck in traffic, we stubbed our toe, and of course harder things. Oftentimes, if you just take a deep breath, don't curse God, don't curse the table that stubbed your toe, don't curse yourself for being a clutch, just wait a second, you may see an amazing blessing hidden behind what seems to be a spiritual boo-boo.
I want to add an underlying message in what you said, is because it's, of course, as you pointed out, particularly in the illness of the house. And Rashi points out there that this is only true when we come into Israel. Like you said, the narrative explanation that the Canaanites hid their treasures there. But there's something fundamental about that, is that I think in order to discover the blessing that difficulties offer, and it's important, to accept them as difficulties. Meaning, I find it very frustrating when people move immediately to, oh, this is for the good, and there's a blessing in here, without embracing the difficulty and the pain. There's nothing to be gained from running away from. It has to be a running into. So how do you cross that bridge? Well, it's specifically represented by the land of Israel. Because there's a permanence of residence, and therefore a commitment. You know, this house, if it were a tent in the wilderness, and you suddenly get this spiritual stain there, what are you going to do? You're going to pack it up and you go somewhere else. Here, when your house gets sick, when you're in the land of Israel, no, this is where I belong, it's where I am, and it's my commitment to being there that's going to cause me to dig underneath. And in that same sense, there's sort of a counter-teaching that you know that up until the time of the Chatam Sofer, or the great leader of Hungarian and German Jewry in the beginning of the 19th century, he held that it was forbidden to build a house of stone outside of the land of Israel. Because it was too permanent.
Wow.
Because one had to understand.
I never heard that.
Yeah, one had to understand that our residence outside of the land of Israel is characterized by not only the willingness, but sometimes the eagerness to move on. Whereas what it means to live here in Israel, even if the house in which I live has this terrible stain and I have to get everything turned out on the street and it's embarrassing and difficult, okay, well, that's because ultimately my commitment to staying in that house is what's going to offer me the treasures that lie underneath.
So speaking of houses, we are right now at the Greg Cafe here at beautiful Mamilla Mall. I'm looking out the window. I see glorious clouds. And I see also, and I look behind me, I see the pedestrian walkway that is the Mamilla Mall. And I must say that it is gorgeous. It is full of life and full of people walking towards the old city or towards the center of town. Just fantastic. And it is important to remember that as we talked about earlier, only 20 years ago, this was a barren, no man's land. And today it is just one of the most bustling areas in Jerusalem. And that is literally rebirth. And one of the head maitre d's, or whatever they're called here, at the cafe, just looked at me as you and I were talking words of Torah, and he gave me a big smile. And that big smile said to me, like, thank you for talking Torah here at Greg Cafe. In this reborn part of Jerusalem. Not only is it reborn, but it's reborn and it's flowing with life. There's a river of life right below here. I also want to thank our good friend Jack for dedicating the show to his wife Lillian and his sister Sarah. God bless you guys, and keep it coming, because you are helping this flow of Torah and of the rebirth of the Jewish people in the land of Israel take place. I also want to thank the good folks at Capone Defense, who teach us how to fight, how to be fighters. Rabbi Mike, you teach us so much how to be a spiritual fighter, and we also have to marry that with being physical fighters, so that bad guys will never take advantage of us, so that we can have that spiritual renaissance in the land of Israel. So check out CaponeDefense.com. That's right, Capone, K-A-P-O-N, defense.com. I also want to thank the good people of Hebron for letting me do this show. That's my day job, which is to be the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron. I'm the consigliere for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. At least I'd like to think of myself as that. So come visit Hebron and let me know. If you're interested in visiting Hebron, write me an email to yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And thelandofisrael.com is an incredible premier network of amazing content from the land of Israel. And I want you to check out more of Rabbi Mike's and Sulam Yaakov's amazing Torah, and that's found at sulamyaakov.com. So check it out. You will be filled with continuing Torah education, and there's so much to prepare for this Passover, Pesach. Let us seal the deal on today's show by talking about this Sabbath. This Shabbat is Shabbat HaGadol. We have a few Shabbats that have a name, and this one is called the Big Sabbath, the big one, right? The Big Sabbath. And this is the Sabbath that prepares us for Passover, for the kind of It's like you know that we're going to be born. You know that the birth is going to happen at a certain time, and so this is the preparation. And one of the things that marks the Big Sabbath, the Shabbat HaGadol, is that we usually we have a custom to read the whole Haggadah, the text of Passover, and also we usually hear a rabbi's speech. That's just one of the main customs. You kind of have to hear the Drashat Shabbat HaGadol. That's like one of the things that you got to do on this Shabbat. So what's Shabbat HaGadol all about?
Well, you know, the Sorim Kedoshim, you know, the tradition teaches us that before any Chag, before any festival, the light of that festival appears in the world in the preceding Shabbat, which means that the light of freedom and emunah, the deep faithfulness to God and the Torah and our history, will already be pouring into the world come this Shabbat. And this is one of the reasons that we read the Haggadah, that we go hear the drasha, that we try to build kelim, we try to build vessels to receive that light already. And if you think, historically speaking, it marks the time when the one action which the Jewish people did, which Am Yisrael did in the process of the Exodus, was done on this day. What was it? When we were going to make the Passover offering, Moshe came to us early at the instructions of God and said, listen, I want you to take a goat in front of all the Egyptians, because, of course, the Egyptians worshipped it as their god, tie it to a bedpost for 4 days. So that every Egyptian that sees it says, hey, man, what's with the goat tied to your bedpost? And the answer is, oh, when we're ready, when our God says so, we're going to slaughter your God, we're going to eat it whole, and we're going to walk on out of here. Right? And that power of, I mean, the absurdity of these slave people who've been enslaved for hundreds of years, looking at their masters while they're still enslaved, they're still in Egypt, and saying, it's over already. Your culture's dead man walking. We are already on the train to the future, right? And that power of unbounded faith, that knowing that even though what you see is not yet expressive of the reality, it's simply not yet in the sense of od ma'at yavo. It's just a little bit more and it'll come.
And there's also the element of defiance, which is to defy the world, to defy the expectations, to defy fear, to defy fear, and to defy fear.
And to not let it define.
Right.
Absolutely.
And that's why I really like this Shabbat. It's a little bit of defiance. And all of us have to defy a little bit of our own expectations, as we said, about ourselves. We have to defy ourselves a little bit. We have to defy our the self-imposed limitations. And they may be even deeply held beliefs. By the way, that's one of the greatest things about joining the IDF, is that you learn that a lot of times your own self-imposed definitions of your own limitations are just that.
Yes.
And that you're able to much, much more than you think.
For a decade, I was a guide and an instructor in the outdoors, climbing, boating, hiking. And the primary principle of outdoor education, which I was taught, which I employed, which is, I believe you can do more than you believe you can. You right. never say it to someone, because that's demeaning. But you simply hold that posture. I've pushed more people up and over mountains, made them do things that they swore and cried and puked that they couldn't do. And at the end of it, looked at them and said, see?
Well,
you could do it.
I think we should all swear, cry, and puke that we're going to exodus Egypt.
We're getting out, man.
We're getting out. And we're also getting out of our own personal Egypts and the Egypts that others want to impose on us. Certainly today, as the Jewish people are exploding forth, there are efforts to hem us in, to box us in, to keep us in a tight little noose so that we don't get out of hand, so it doesn't explode too much, so that we don't make anybody look smaller, or whatever other reasons they want, or maybe because they don't want our God to shine. But it's not going. Nothing's going to stop us now.
All it is Mitzarim, right? In Hebrew, Egypt is Mitzrayim, which means Mitzarim. It's a narrow place. You ever doing a boating? You ever been in a canoe or a kayak in white water? What happens when the river gets narrow?
The water goes fast.
Oh yeah, it picks up momentum.
Right.
All that effort to close us down and box us in right now is simply serving the purpose of gathering our momentum and energy so that when we shoot out into the freedom that lies ahead of us, we will be like a rocket in the night.
Amazing. Great mashal, great paradigm, a great
metaphor.
Metaphor. I appreciate it very much. And I want to thank you very much, Rabbi Mike Foyer. I want to wish you success in making your awesome matzah. this year and having that that bursting forth. And all of you out there as well, write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. If you have any questions or thoughts for Rabbi Mike, and people have had that recently, I've been forwarding him emails, so please do so. Write me an email. Don't get lazy. Connect on Twitter. Connect on Facebook. Connect on YouTube. Connect on LinkedIn. Connect any way you want. More than anything, look back into the Torah, into the Bible. Connect with the God of Israel. Connect with the fulfillment of prophecy, which is the return of the Jewish people's return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel by being part of the story. Rabbi Mike, have a great Pesach, and thank you so much for being with us.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach and Shalom. Stay tuned. More great stuff is on the way.